Yeah, so we've had some interesting experiences with this, as you might imagine. Early on, you know, thankfully, I think pretty much all of our H-1Bs live in the same area of employment. You know, part of that is probably because this is Texas and people's notion of what's a normal commute, you know, is pretty expansive. You know, so yeah, there was a lot of the, okay, this is going to sound weird, but I need you to take this notice and post it at your house for 10 days, you know, 10 business days. You know, there was a lot of that. And then as the year went on, looking at what was going to happen with new filings where we didn't know where the people were going to work. You know, for a lot of us, and this includes my office, you know, we gave up half of our office space because we were working remotely. We still need to go there, you know, typically once a week for each of us because, as y'all know, the federal government is very attached to paper, and so there's a lot of printing and scanning and all that. But, you know, for a lot of the other folks, you know, a lot of the people that do our IT stuff, you know, they gave up their offices, and pretty much everybody in their departments was moving to permanently telecommuting or to some hoteling situations where they were going to have some kind of shared space, and they were still working out the details. So some of that we were able to address just by, you know, well, we know it's going to be at this location, even if we don't know what cubicle or whatever they're going to have. But that's been an interesting thing as the year has gone on. To my surprise, we haven't gotten quite as many RFEs as I would have thought we would get. Because in the past, you know, sometimes when we would list even some facilities that were not owned by us, but which were leased, we would get RFEs saying, hey, this appears to be like a shopping mall or whatever. That was a pleasant surprise, but it has been kind of interesting getting that figured out. At least the current LCA, I think, is a little easier to manage multiple work sites on than some of the ones in the past where you could only put a few. Still a pain in the behind. As far as, you know, so I haven't had to confront the situation where we had somebody that was moving out of the area of employment to where we would have needed to do a whole amended filing. I'm sure that that's not going to last, but we've been fortunate on that. The other thing we looked at was changes in duties. You know, we were fortunate in that we did not have the same kind of furlough things at the beginning. What we had instead was, you know, yeah, at one point we were dealing with a financial hardship because, you know, I think we were spending something like $15 million a month on PPE. You know, some of these things. And there was a while before some of the reimbursements for those things started coming in. And so our leadership had come up with this plan where they were going to require everyone to take a certain number of days off. I think it was like 8 days off in 8 weeks or something like that. Because that would, at least on paper, it would reduce a liability and help the financial bottom line. But, you know, that's, you know, for most of us U.S. workers, that was, you know, not convenient necessarily. You know, maybe you had to use some of your vacation time. It was kind of annoying, but it was hopefully going to mean we wouldn't need to, you know, lay anyone off. And then for our H-1Bs, it was a whole different complication because how do we do that without running afoul of our LCA obligations? You know, and where we ultimately ran into a problem was with some of the newer H-1B employees where they did not have accrued vacation. So it's not like they could take paid time off the same way that most of the U.S. workers could. And ultimately, I think we just decided that, you know, you just can't enforce this policy on those folks because there's no way we can do it and still be in compliance with the LCA. And it wasn't something where it made sense for us to do an amended LCA filing when it wasn't a permanent reduction in hours. But there was a lot of uncertainty about that. As far as workers abroad, the issues that we ran into were some of those that like you said, it wasn't actually they weren't primarily immigration law issues because from an immigration law standpoint, you know, the folks aren't here, they don't have an immigration status. You know, we're still if they're continuing to work for us, they're getting paid the same they work here. So there was never an issue of needing different terms than what was on their H-1B stuff. But it would get us into other areas of law that were significant to the employer. So even though it wasn't my turf, as it were, you know, we still had to be aware of, okay, well, can this person work in this country without potentially subjecting us to, you know, some payroll tax issues or liabilities? You know, in our case, because we have a lot of researchers that deal with vaccines and pathogens and so on, you get into an issue about export restricted materials. Because even if they're not taking actual material with them, you know, in some cases, some of the information they may be dealing with may be subject to export control restrictions. You know, strictly speaking, none of that is my turf. You know, but I think it's very helpful as an immigration lawyer, if you're working with corporate or institutional clients that might have those situations, to be aware. You know, I think your bigger employers, hopefully, are already going to have pretty sophisticated corporate counsel to address some of those things. But some of the smaller ones, you know, y'all might have seen it before when we first started doing those export control attestations on the I-129 forms. You know, for a lot of smaller clients, it's not that the export control laws were new; they just had never had to pay any attention to those things. So I think it's a good area for an immigration lawyer to be helpful to issue spot and just